Welcome to House of Comments. We're still here. We've not been replaced. We're not on our way out. We haven't broken any codes just yet, but that might be because we haven't written. Well, we don't know, and that might be just because we haven't written any. We're out of control, aren't we, Emma? How are you?
Absolutely. I'm fine, knackered, but fine. What
Good.
about
Yeah, I'm
you?
sure at home. I'm also getting on the tired side, but I'm fine. There's a lot to unpack. We could have, I say this every week now, but there's really a whole host of subjects we could have picked this week. But we're going to have to start kind of where we finished last week, which is, well, Nadeem Zahawi, you and I both thought it was rather unsustainable, his position. And so it proved before the Sunday.
Everyone knew he was going. It was quite funny because he was going for so long and then he went really quickly. And it's like, due process, due process, due process-ish.
Well, no, I've been a bit, I've flipped back and forth on this all week, actually, thinking about what I was going to say on the show. And so there was due process. The independent ethics advisor, Sir Laurie Magnus, went through it and was like, no, there's serious breach of the ministerial code. Goodbye. And Rishi Sunak sacked him on Sunday morning, which probably at least saved him some grief on the Sunday morning shows. He'd had enough grief throughout the rest of the week, so he at least managed to avoid a bit of that. So we both said, didn't we, last week, like, this is only ending one way, come on.
Yeah, of course it will.
But there was due process, and he did, the minute that process was complete, inevitably he was sacked.
Was
So
Zahawi saying he was only interviewed for half an hour? Now, I mean, I don't have a massive amount of sympathy for him, but if the whole having a proper process, proper as it was, I mean, it wasn't really long, was in order to give Rishi Sunak a buffer zone to say, look, I believe in proper process.
And also, that is right in principle.
It is and it isn't. You could absolutely have suspended Zahawi and
Ah,
any of
yes.
the other ministers who are currently under investigation.
Well, you and I both said last week, didn't we, that probably the easiest way to navigate this would have to have removed him from post pending investigation, saying, I hope this clears your name and you can come back and serve as and when. We both said that, didn't we? Or
So
said,
they
and
need to
actually,
have it quite clearly timed around the media rather than around how long the process took. It just stinks a little bit. So like either do it or don't do it. But this half-assed, I mean, yeah, we're going to be a government of integrity-ish. It's half-assed.
you see, this is why I've been flipping back and forth all week on it, because I'm a bit stuck on whether it was a proper post. I also think the issues surrounding Zahawi are slightly different to what's going on with Dominic Raab, because the Zahawi thing was a bit of a messy financial thing. You probably do have to spend a bit of time digging around. Again, Dominic Raab. You could obviously, there's a lot of allegations around bullying. Feels to me like the vultures are swirling around him now, circling around him. And it wouldn't surprise me if next week we come on the show and he's not there. Would it surprise you very much?
They're saying weeks for this one.
You think this is going to be weeks? I
Yeah.
wonder if the pressure on the dam is going to be too much and it's going to burst. But yeah, you might be right. We might hold on for a few more weeks. Not sure that's great for the government. It's all
I
because.
mean, the problem is if we're looking at 3 to 4 weeks, then we're looking at right at the as
Yeah.
we enter into the local
Yeah.
elections.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's all getting very messy. Obviously, Dominic Raab was a big supporter of Rishi Sunak originally, was rewarded by that by getting a very senior role in the government, becoming the Deputy Prime Minister. You could make, we don't, Suella Braverman was found to have broken the ministerial code under one Prime Minister. 6 days later, she was back in office under another prime minister. Are people going to go after her next? Well, I mean, we'll have to see. But given the
Well,
way
I mean,
politics.
I think it's going to be really, really hard if they're sacked, all these sackings for breaking the ministerial code, not to ask questions about Suella Braverman.
Well, if you're Labour, that's surely what your next play is going to have to
Yeah, of
be, isn't
course.
it?
Well, I mean, it does depend on how much more scandal comes out about how many more Tory cabinet ministers.
Yeah, we don't know. Look,
yeah, Suella Braverman might be at the end of a very long queue by the end of next week. We just don't know.
We don't know. We jokingly called last week's show Party Like It's 1992. And it is starting to feel like that. It's really starting to feel whatever you think. In fact, whatever you think of the individual complaint, and in fact, whatever one thinks about how Rishi Sunak is dealing with any of them, the sort of ongoing flow of them is just, it's just so damaging for a government and a prime minister, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, it's just mired. That word mired, it's so graphic, bogged down, unable to get out of the, there was a wonderful video of some protesters recently and the police were going after them, but they all got stuck in the mud. And these poor police, they could not get themselves out of the mud. And it was, I mean, it was bloody hilarious. I'm sorry. And that's what, that is a perfect metaphor for where the government are at the moment, flailing around, unable to move, unable to get anything done, unable to get out of the mud of their own making.
Yeah, and actually, look, I get why you as a Labour supporter would be like, this is great for Labour, but it's really not good for the country. I wanted...
No, I agree. And I don't think I did say it's great for Labour.
No, but I can... you didn't say it, but look, any Labour supporter would be... you know, any Labour supporter would be keen to see the Conservatives in the mud.
For Labour, because we've said this is what they're like. And it turns out they were worse than we could have even imagined.
The problem is you can't even fight that line because of all the things going on. We both said, didn't we, last week, there's loads of good people who go into politics for the right reasons. But at the moment, people at the top of government are not doing very much to endorse our argument. Yeah. And I wanted Rishi Sunak to become the Prime Minister and to be successful at it for the good of the country. We needed stability. We needed calm. And then you fight a general election on those terms. But he just...
He's not up to it. He can't get himself out of this mud that he's stuck in.
The party can't. And I don't know if it's his fault because it's everyone else screwing up around him.
Oh, come on, Charlotte. We're about to talk about Brexit. You sound like David Davis now. It's everybody else's fault.
Well, we'll come on to Brexit. I don't know if it's everyone else's fault. And there are things he could have done better. Of course there
are. Absolutely, he's in charge.
And ultimately, he is in charge. That's absolutely right. And it always comes back to the person at the top. It just does.
I'm not being funny, but there's a reason Dominic Raab's in post. There's a reason Suella Braverman's in post. And that reason is Rishi Sunak.
Yeah, he did deals with them and to get become Prime Minister. That's unequivocally true. And we should say before we move on, actually, there's a story in the Times today that Simon Case... knew about the cabinet secretary who keeps popping up in these stories, doesn't he? He was apparently told about the bullying allegations against Dominic Raab before Rishi Sunak brought him back.
Head civil servant Simon Case, whichever.
This is not going to be the last time we discuss either of these people, is it? Okay. Happy anniversary, Emma.
Happy anniversary. No, my day in Australia 3 years ago. That's what you mean, right?
Yeah. No, I meant of us and our love and our working relationship. No, it's Brexit. 3 years ago this week, the transition period ended and we properly left the EU. We will remember those nights, the sort of cheering parties in squares in the centre of London. People were
I was down under, mate.
I was probably having a strong drink or something.
I was somewhat ironically watching my brother become a citizen of another country.
Right. Well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? But it's gone great, hasn't it? I can't think of anything that hasn't improved. I can't think of any way Brexit is limiting us. I can't do it. I'm sorry. Look, you and I are both pretty unequivocal in our Remain support, perhaps for different reasons, perhaps not, but whatever. It was pretty clear. We voted Remain. It was... I've got to ask you this, actually. If you had a chance to vote Return, not Remain, and bear in mind the terms on which we would have to return, mm-hmm. How would you vote?
I probably would vote to Return, but... like, I'm not that emotionally attached to the pound or whatever. I am happy about freedom of movement and Schengen and all that. That would be fine by me. I think it would be a real struggle. I was talking about the other day what the Remain campaign got wrong.
Oh, we don't have enough time on this show. We don't have enough time on this show for that.
But we keep talking, and all the coverage is about how Brexit has hurt us economically, and it has, and there's just no two ways about that.
Well, we've had a lot of economic data and economic forecasts over the last couple of weeks, and, well, the most stark thing this week for me, I don't know if you saw this chart, was the G7, numbers of G7 came out, growth predictions. We were the only one in negative growth. Our numbers were worse than Russia.
The IMF forecast. Look, but we're about to make the same mistake. Brexit wasn't an economic decision for most of the people who voted.
Very good point.
It was a cry from people who have felt ignored, felt left out, felt left behind for a really, really long time. And I think we need to deal with that feeling, however we manage it, however that happens, and levelling up has got to be a key part of that, first, before we start making middle-class people like me feel happy by trying to go back into Europe. I think once that group of voters... Now, I think Brexit was the wrong answer for them, but for once, I want to see that group of voters culturally satisfied that they have been prioritized for once.
Look, the people voted for Brexit for all different reasons, but there was clearly one clear group that voted for it in that reason, and we know that in no small part because they then voted for Boris Johnson offering very similar to fulfill all that quote unquote red wall stuff was in large part about that, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just feel like they've been absolutely screwed front and back. And we need to stop screwing people, particularly people who are, you know, have essentially given us an existential scream of pain. And our entire response was to go, no, we don't like it. And I don't like it. I don't like Brexit. I don't want it to be happening, but it is. And I think got to move into the territory where we go, right, well, this has happened, and let's stop talking about leave, remain, Brexit, rejoin, and let's start talking about what we need to do culturally, economically, politically, to make the UK better now in the circumstances in which we find ourselves.
And we all have a different perspective on what that looks like, and that's fine. We can debate that on those terms. That's absolutely fine. But you're definitely right on a lot of key points there, that a lot of it wasn't people checking their wallets and looking into their bank accounts and working out what would be better.
Yeah.
There was definitely a key set of that 52% that were like, well, it can't get worse.
Yeah.
So let's do it. And that's for various reasons. And like you, I'm a sort of, I'm very comfortable with freedom of movement because I'm a lily-livered liberal metropolitan elite. And I love, you know, freedom of movement. I love people coming here. I'm very pro-immigration. I'm very, very pro-freedom of movement. I think those things enhance all countries. But again, I can understand why if you're in a different place to London and you feel that your town or city has been dramatically changed and you might not think that's good by the things that I like, I can see why you would rebel against that and try and vote to end that. As it happens, I don't think it's very good for the country, you know. This idea that we were going to pull off these magical trade deals and not take any financial hit after leaving the closest partnership with our closest market, it was just absurd.
Oh yeah, all the economics of Brexit were absurd. It was it was always an economic fantasy pipe dream, and this, as soon as they tried to do anything remotely approaching the Singapore on Thames shit that they were talking about, Liz Truss got battered Although apparently she's coming back.
Well, yeah, that's going to be quite fun.
We do say, you know, we need to have resilient politicians who can put their ideas out there. But Jesus, woman, have some freaking dignity.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's resilience. I think that might be called audacity. But anyway, no doubt we'll have a chance to speak about that. But I mean, actually, to be honest, while you mentioned Liz Truss, let's talk about her flip from liberal Remainer, liberal in the small L sense of the word, the kind of classical liberal sense of the word, to Brexit.
Well, she was also one of your lot at uni, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was a young Liberal Democrat, absolutely. And then has sort of flipped to pretend she was a... I mean, she had all the, like, fervour of a convert, didn't she?
Yeah. Well, that's it, isn't it?
She became more Brexit more right than... She became more Brexit than the actual Brexiteer Rishi Sunak in their campaign. Anyway, that was quite funny, don't know, to watch.
The whole Britannia Unhinged thing.
Yeah, I mean...
Nearly got away with that.
You nearly got away. I was not going to let you go. It was Britannia Unchained, but very good. Just that Singapore on Thames 6. Now, you won't be surprised to know that there is a world and a set of scenarios where I could have got behind that. It was actually a beautiful spectator cover right before the election, before the referendum, that was a butterfly with a flag of St. George, it's a Great British flag, and it was coming out of an EU box or whatever, and it said out and into the world, which is kind of a beautiful way of, you know, it's a nice positive spin on Brexit. But the point is, throughout the campaign, that was never what was on offer.
No.
That was... They can pretend at different points that that's what they want now. That was never what the central Brexit campaign was offering at any point. And
also, we're saying that Singapore is not the low state place that people think it is. Singapore is, for example, has incredibly high social regulation. It builds an awful lot of social housing. An awful lot of people live in state-owned housing. It's not the place that its fantasists like to think it is. It just doesn't regulate its financial market very much. Which I wonder why that's the bit they're focused on.
But just the point is, it was Brexit. Again, I don't want to diminish the people that voted for Brexit, but the people who were leading that campaign were not, I don't think, trying to lead a out and into the world, big outward-looking campaign. As I recall it from, you know, nearly 7 years ago now, that was never what was on offer. Think about what Nigel Farage's offer was talking about. I know he was on a separate campaign, but think about even what Boris Johnson, Michael Gove...
Those... The whole Turkey thing, for a start.
Turkey, absolutely. That was really quite a low point. I mean, yeah, Vile is right. It was a true low point of the campaign, all that kind of Turkey's going to join the EU thing, which was, if you look at it in any realistic way, it's just not on the agenda at all. And
A, it wasn't on the agenda, and B, what they were saying is brown people are coming.
Correct. The Muslims are coming. And it was pretty grotesque.
It was grim as hell.
And there was... Look, you and I can be very clear that not all Brexiters are racist. That is unequivocally true. But there was always this rather nasty, xenophobic tone at various points of the Brexit campaign.
They were willing, too many of them, to snuggle up to racism.
It was all a bit of a wink and a nudge, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They were too savvy as political operators to say anything out loud, most of the time, I would say.
Most of the time, yeah.
But there was something nasty. Anyway, we don't really need to relive the campaign and just have a therapy session because, you know, it's done and we lost. And you've rightly insinuated that the Remain campaign was fairly hopeless in the end. It was awful.
It was like fighting the campaign in the letters page of the FT, honestly.
Yeah, it was fairly useless. There's a recent edition of The Economist that calls for a stop to magical thinking about how we now deal with the EU.
Well, this is it. So many Remainers are like, let's just rejoin. It's like they just really haven't grasped how difficult that is, how different that would be. how just politically impossible it is because of any other deal that would have to be done.
Because even Sir Keir Starmer and the Labour Party are not talking about that anymore. Whatever his personal view on me might be, and I think we can guess that he was as despondent as the rest of us about losing that referendum.
Yeah.
He's not pretending that it can. We're going to return.
No, and you can't.
Labour are just not talking about that.
No, Labour will probably bring us into closer alignment in order to make trade more frictionless. That is probably where Labour will end up, certainly in the next Parliament, if they're in government. They're not going to rejoin the customs union. They're not going to rejoin the single market, but they will come closer to those the rules of those things internally, domestically, in order to make fiction easy, trade easier.
Yeah, that sounds plausible.
That's where I think we're going to be. And then if anyone wants to revisit this in 10 years' time, there might be the conditions to do so. There certainly are not going to be the conditions to do so before 2030.
At the earliest.
Yeah, exactly.
And there is obviously a fundamental difference between the two parties. The Conservatives really had to find the sort of hardest form of Brexit possible to appease a relatively small group of backbenchers who probably are not particularly in line with what most of the country actually thinks.
Yeah.
You know, being able to trade properly because you've got similar regulations is not getting Brexit done.
No, exactly. Exactly.
It's actually getting Brexit done in a practical way that works, for example. But obviously, the spectre of the ERG looms large. And, you know, this will be a thing, you know, shock. The Conservative Party are rowing about Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, that has been going on throughout both of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And will do until we die, and or the party dies, whichever happens first.
I just think the question is, where really do we go from here? And if I had a good answer to that, I'd be a very rich consultant at the heart of Westminster, and I absolutely don't. I am neither of those things. So I don't truly know. But I think I return to that Economist cover, and it demands everyone from all parties, and frankly on the EU side as well, to behave like grown-ups now, doesn't it? And actually, you can argue that we need the EU more than us, but you know, us not being part of the EU is no small loss to the EU either. I think
we're not as big a loss as we think we are.
That's probably true. The EU, it's not insignificant.
Would like to trade with us, but I don't think we're like, oh my God, their number one priority.
Clearly, that's true. That is, I mean, all the evidence.
So we need to be realistic about that. They need to be realistic about how we make that happen. And I think it, now that we've not got that idiot David Frost negotiating, now that we haven't got that idiot Boris Johnson in charge, that might be easier. It sounds like they're getting somewhere in Northern Ireland, at least.
I mean, we spent 15-20 minutes talking about Brexit, and we haven't actually mentioned Northern Ireland, which is just such a complex quagmire of a mess that was, again, could only have been a problem. But it could only have been a problem. There was no way that leaving the EU was not going to be a problem for Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah.
It could never be any different.
No, and it's so bizarre that the DUP supported it.
I know. I've always thought I've never been able to get my head around that. That might be because I don't understand the intricacies of Northern Irish politics enough. But yes, that always seemed quite bizarre to me. But, you know, there were points, and thankfully it seems things have currently stabilised. But there was points where it felt quite on a knife edge in Northern Ireland after Brexit. And
yeah, there was bloodshed. I mean, Lyra McKee was killed.
Things were
getting nasty again.
That was a horrendous event.
Like, it settled down, but they haven't had a government for nearly 2 years.
Sinn Féin won the poll, didn't they? And then there's just been no functioning government.
Yeah.
I'm pleased you mentioned Lyra McKee, because that's coming up to an anniversary as well. It must be, mustn't it? And for those that don't know, Lyra McKee was a young journalist, Northern Irish journalist. She did some fantastic work. I messaged Lyra quite a lot on Twitter, and we always one of these tragic things where we're like, yeah, yeah, come to London, we'll go and get a drink.
Yeah.
And then, and one night she was covering a protest and a bullet hit. Anyway, a horrendous story. I'm going to take a little handbrake turn here because I haven't answered this, but I want to ask you, can you think of anything that is better because of Brexit or has been better because we've left the EU? I do have an answer to this.
Well, immigration has gone down as a concern. So the country sort of feels like it's put that to bed a bit.
Do you think so? I'm not sure polls would suggest that.
No, that is what polls suggest. That's what I'm saying. It's dropped significantly down. I mean, it's not...
Maybe I'm conflating...
It's not 10, but it's you know, it's no longer number one with a bullet.
Maybe I'm conflating the concern over small boats with immigration
as
a general.
Yeah, small boats is an issue. I'm on GB News often enough to know that people don't... But it's... And it's fascinating because immigration, of course, itself has gone up. We've actually had record numbers of immigration. But concern about immigration has gone down because people feel that they've done Brexit. Mm-hmm. Now, it may well rise again, but it doesn't feel quite as divisive as it did, say, in 2015.
Okay. So my answer is the vaccine rollout.
Oh, 3 extra hours.
Well, I think it was longer than 3 extra hours. I'm going to defend it slightly. Now, I'm going to say this with the huge caveat throughout that the EU of it did catch up with us about a month, 6 weeks. I don't remember exact timing.
The 3 hour thing is there was a 3 hour period in which it looked like they might not give a certain type of permission for export.
I'm talking about
that's bollocks. We're going to do that.
Sure.
So that, we could always have done our vaccine rollout in the timetable that we did. There was a 3 hour period where it might not have been quite as possible as it was.
No, I'm talking about something different. I'm going to talk about something. I'm going to slightly defend this. So I absolutely understand, and it was fantastic that the EU absolutely caught up with us. If you look at any of the raw numbers about, let's say, it might have been 4, it might have been 6, it might have been 8 weeks later, but whatever, the speed of the rollout caught up in the EU. But we obviously were able to, and it's particularly true with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was a key part of the opening to our vaccine campaign, that happened quicker and we were able to go it alone because of being out with the EU. Now, do I think we would not have had a successful vaccine rollout because we were in the EU? No, I don't think that. We clearly would have, because look at what happened in the EU. But I think you can make that argument that we started quicker and faster and could get going and could had the freedom to approve that AstraZeneca vaccine because we were out of the EU. And I think that's a good thing. But it's about the only thing I can think of. And now that's a big win.
And as I say, it is contested.
Yeah, it is. And as I say, like, they caught up and that's great. And it was, you know, we would not have had a failed vaccine rollout because we were in the EU. That is not what would have happened. But it definitely sort of helped the boost at the beginning and helped people feel good about it and be involved in it. So that's my only offering in my attempt for balance and to try and be positive about this thing that I didn't vote for. But yeah, we're sort of coming to the end of the show. And the question we do have to keep asking, I've asked it a couple of times in this episode, is what will happen next? And you're right to say that there seems to be a bit more of a grown-up discussion between this government, a bit less posturing, I think I would put it.
Yeah.
And also,
just get David Frost as far away as possible from any talking to anyone that matters.
That, yes. I also think it's... The EU has sort of, the anger from the EU leaders has subsided as well.
Well, that's because they've got David Frost as far away as possible from anyone.
There's a bit of that. And I think time is a great healer as well. Let's not be under illusion. They were happy to be a bit spiteful at the beginning as well.
The EU needed to prove that it was a stupid idea.
Correct.
In case anyone else thought it might not be.
Correct.
But they didn't really need to do a great deal to prove that because it was a stupid idea.
It certainly was a bad idea. And the EU absolutely responded, okay, in a way we could have predicted by going, okay, have fun, you're on your own. We could have also predicted that. So,
yeah. And, you know, we turned around and said a big F you to the EU. And then everyone's getting butthurt because they weren't like, falling over themselves to say, no, don't.
Yeah, but I do think, you know, EU leaders have not been equally concessionary or, you know, taken on some of the reasons why.
Exactly equally conciliatory.
Yeah. Look, it needs grown-ups on both sides, doesn't it? It needs, and I think we're now moving to that space, and that can only be a good thing for, particularly for Britain, and it's not, you know, it's a good thing for the EU as well. So let's hope that that kind of more adult, calmer way, less fractious way of dealing with this does continue.
Yes.
Because it's pretty clear from any economic data you look at for the UK that we certainly need it. We need it to perhaps cool down the independence anger and the anger in Scotland. We certainly need it to make sure things stay stable and move forward in Northern Ireland. There's a whole host of issues that need to be settled. And as we know, the government is trying to do this whole rush to get rid of every EU law. I think even David Davis has spoken out against that and been somewhat concerned about why this might be, how this is happening. And that, because it could leave people in really tricky water of getting rid of legislation that actually, so what if it's from the EU? It's the country needs it. What's the point of spending parliamentary time?
This is what's coming. This idiotic.
By the end of the year.
Yeah, it's just completely unworkable.
It's probably unworkable. It also doesn't seem that necessary if we're going to just rewrite the legislation to do the same things. That does not seem like a good use of parliamentary time to me. It's all right rescinding laws.
You'll get the Brexiteers, the really mad ones, cross because we adopt most of it. You'll get the Remainers mad because they'll be like, well, why don't we just not do this stupid bill? Completely unnecessary. And you'll get a complete waste of parliamentary time, civil service time, all of which could be better spent on things we need to do much more in the middle of a cost of living crisis, in the middle of a public services crunch.
It doesn't seem to be a good use of anyone's time. It is perfectly valid to say we no longer want this piece of legislation, so we're getting rid of it. That's fine. If you as a democratically elected government don't want to have that in law anymore, fine, happens. But if you're going to keep the same thing because you think it's good for the country or we need it to do trade or whatever else, how is this a good use of anyone's time?
Well, it's not. But then that's this government for you.
I just don't. It seems a complete bizarre to me.
It has to be done. I think Rishi Sunak hasn't got the strength or the leeway not to do the things that his backbenchers want him to do. That really is where we're at politically.
But also, it's not only about Rishi Sunak, because Boris Johnson was going to do this, Liz Truss would have done, whoever was the Conservative leader basically would have done this.
Yeah, but the post-Liz Truss government is all about supposedly like doing things in a more sensible same way than Boris Johnson or Liz Truss. So he doesn't have to do it. Nobody has to do it, but he has to do it because he's completely in hock to the ERG.
I mean, whoever the Conservative leader will be seems to have to navigate this. And it just seems I can't keep repeating myself. It just seems a bizarre use of time. And I think we might end up with some quite silly, unnecessary problems. Someone looks at something and goes, this doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
I think some lawyers at some point down the road might end up doing very well from this.
Yes.
Well, there we go. That's our happy anniversary. That is 3 years since Emma's now filling in her documents to head over to Australia with her brother. So we're going to have to find a new time to record the show that fits in both. I'm excited to talk to Emma at 1 o'clock in the morning Aussie time. But until then, while you book your flights, remind people where they can find you.
I'm on Twitter at @EmmaBurnell_, and I have a newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on the Twitters, and you can find me at theaddition.substack.com. Please do let us know what you think of the show, what topics you want us to discuss. tell us why Brexit is a fantastic thing. It's at HOC Podcast on the Twitters. So please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. Please do, if you think your friends and family would enjoy the show, please share it with them so we get more listeners, more people coming into this, the House of Comments community. We'd love to hear from people. But until next week, thanks for listening.